Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I forgot to say the, but welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can keep up to date with our most recent episodes on themacguffinman.com. We recently talked about A Fish Called Wanda. Prior to that was Rosemary's Baby. Prior to that was The Lost City of Zed. And before that was Point Blank and The Limey, both on one podcast, for reasons that if you have seen both movies are pretty obvious. You can check those out at themacguffinman.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yeah.
Here we are talking about another film. And what is that film?
Do you want me to say the word "the" in front of it? Or
I think it's canon. To say the word "that."
Okay, we're talking about The Killing.
Yeah, in the Kubrick extended universe, it is officially known as The Killing.
Right, and we're talking about The Killing, the Kubrick 1956 film, not the television show.
Exactly, the television show that everybody has forgotten about. By this
point. Yeah. Yeah,
even people that watch that show have forgotten about it. Joel Kinnaman is not memorable. Anyway, continue.
Some fun connections from this one to some stuff we've talked about recently too.
Alicia Cook Jr. I recall that he's in Rosemary's Baby. what else do we got?
This is less of a direct connection, but they said this was supposed to be like the Lavender Hill Mob. Was that movie that
that Charles Crichton directed?
Yeah, that Charles Crichton did. So this is
and Charles Crichton is the director of A Fish Called Wanda, for people that didn't listen to that podcast.
Alicia Cook Jr. still doing his job very well.
Yeah. It's a real cast of characters in this movie, but they're all enjoyable. I think Sterling Hayden is great. There are not a lot of like 1950s era actors that I'm like, every time I see this guy in a movie, I'm like, I'm on board. Sterling Hayden is one of those people.
Yeah, and it's one of those roles that is it is kind of flat in a way, just because he's supposed to be this tough guy and you're not supposed to see him have many facets of his personality. It's like he's tough and he's good at what he does and he's tough. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
It's hard to find someone who can do that in an interesting way. But, you know, some actors that we and, you know, the film community really likes, they're just so good at doing what seems so simple that they kind of seem miles ahead of other people doing the same thing, like a Clint Eastwood or, you know, some of these reticent actors. I know you probably might feel that way about some of Tom Hardy's less wordy roles, that there's not much on paper for him to do, but he manages to take, as I said, somewhat of a flat character and make it pretty dynamic. And I agree with Sterling Hayden in this play. I mean, the aptly named Johnny Clay.
Yeah.
Even just from the name alone, you get this idea of this pretty one-dimensional character. And I think it is largely one-dimensional. You know, there isn't a big arc here. There's not a big transformation, but he just plays it in such an interesting way and has this somehow this very cold charisma to him that works very well for this character and this genre in this time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that I appreciate the most about him is that his acting doesn't really scream 1950s at you either, you know? And I know we've talked about this, or specifically I've talked about this a lot on the podcast. There's this line, it's most conveniently you can point to Marlon Brando's ascension as when people on film started to realize that you can act, you don't have to act like you're in theater, in the theater anymore. Like, you don't have to project everything you're saying. And that's not to say Marlon Brando was the first person that did that. Jimmy Stewart is underrated for his influence on this. And there are probably a million other actors who were more subtle than that I would give them credit for, just because I don't watch enough of these movies. But Sterling Hayden there's a performance aspect to him that feels like he wouldn't have been out of place acting like this in a movie in 1982, you know? He never, I don't know, there's like a, there's a projecting that he doesn't do, you know? And I think we talked about this a little bit with Alicia Cook Jr. and Rosemary's Baby a couple weeks ago, how he is just so over the top and performative, and his facial expressions are like bigger than they need to be. Another example of somebody from noir movies around this time who I like, who I think was a good performer, is Peter Lorre in The Maltese Falcon. Like, he was a very performative sort of style of actor, and it's just because at a time period in Hollywood, everybody's training came from theater, and it took a while for those theater people to realize, oh, the screen is a little bit different, or the audio of the screen is a little bit different, you know? And I think Sterling Hayden has all those tough guy, like being able to turn a one-dimensional tough guy into something more interesting and human-seeming. He has all those qualities that you explained. But I also think just as an actor, just for this time period, I think he's kind of... he feels sort of ahead of his time, and I think that really helps in a movie like this.
Yeah, and just to speak about that era a bit, as you said, a lot of their training would come from theater, and then but a lot of their formative cinema experiences, you know, growing up watching movies, you're still coming out of like silent era films at this point, where
yeah, absolutely.
They made huge expressions because you know, the technology wasn't that good, and the picture just wasn't that clear sometimes. So between the makeup and the big gestures and the inability to communicate through words, they just had these very stilted big emotions, and doesn't just go away overnight when sound becomes part of film.
Exactly. And to use those two examples of the people that I've said are more sort of performative style of actors, not that Sterling Hayden doesn't fall into this category either, but Alicia Cook Jr. and Peter Lorre both would have been adults by the time the talkie was invented, you know? And yeah. So that falls right in with what you're saying. It's like they're already they're people. They're fully grown people by the time audio exists, you know?
Yeah.
For cinema.
Yeah, and looking at, I mean, to speak just of The Killing more directly in this macro history of film that we're kind of touching on here, this is transitional. I mean, it's a very influential movie in for a lot of ways that I don't, I wasn't able to fully appreciate until reading about it a bit. And it was kind of a bit of that Seinfeld isn't funny effect that we've talked about, that mm-hmm. people watching Seinfeld for the first time now can't really appreciate how different this was for a sitcom. And just some of the editing and some of the filmmaking in this was very different, and definitely left a mark on a lot of people who would go on to make films that we watch and love now.
Yeah, and I would like to hear the examples you were reading about, but I agree. And I think as a general rule throughout Stanley Kubrick's career, and I would like to point out we have somehow yeah. went 7 minutes of this podcast with only, I think we mentioned him in passing at the very beginning. I think this is my greatest performance to date, stifling that urge. But like, if you look at his films, even the ones before this one, this is his first full-length film, but there's like Killer's Kiss before that, Fear and Desire, and then Paths of Glory is his movie after The Killing, which is where I think like proper the Kubrick we know begins with Paths of Glory. That's where he starts to do the 1-point perspective shots, which he would become most famous for. But like, if you, as somebody who a few years ago watched all of Stanley Kubrick's movies pretty close together, and is cognizant of the time when they're released, every time I watch a Stanley Kubrick movie, it looks like something that was made 10 years later than the year it was actually released. And with the exception of Eyes Wide Shut, which feels weirdly old-fashioned for 1999, but that movie's a whole can of worms for a variety of reasons. But yeah, and I think this movie, I remember the first time I saw this movie was when I was watching all those Kubrick movies about 4 or 5 years ago, and I watched this one and was like, shocked at the cinematography, because I know specifically the cinematography, because I know what a 1950s noir movie looks like, and these dolly moves are not from that kind of movie, and they're not from a movie of that decade at all, you know. And and that's the thing that really jumped out at me as being one, very impressively Kubrickian, if you will, and two, just totally ahead of its time, not just for the genre but for cinema in general. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what I've gathered about its influence. I mean, something as small, I mean, this isn't a big thing. I'll build towards, I think, kind of some of the larger trends that come out of this. Mm-hmm. But the clown mask that Johnny wears when we finally see as much of the heist as we see in full is very similar or exact as we see in The Dark Knight.
Nolan mentioned The Killing as a specific reference on the first 5 minutes of The Dark Knight.
Yeah, and it's, as I said, it's one small thing, you know, that the choice of that mask didn't shape cinema in any meaningful way, but just that we can look at this as important to a lot of people who went on to find great success in Hollywood.
Yeah. And Quentin Tarantino and Edgar Wright are also noted super fans of this movie as well. Both people who have made famous heist movies.
Yeah. And that's one of the bigger ones I was going to get to, is that Quentin Tarantino, one of the big things that, you know, things have kind of faded about this in particular as his career has moved on, but particularly Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, just the way that he manipulated time, that's become less of a signature for him, I guess, as time has passed. But when he kind of broke through and everyone said, you know, there's this young guy doing these things and, you know, reshaping the way that we make and watch films, I think that was a big part of it. And we do see we absolutely see the seeds of that in this. And that was kind of what I was getting at when I said, it's hard to appreciate, you know, because it's not like this isn't Inception levels of, you know, manipulating time and having characters deal with all these different levels of time or anything. But just the form of the film itself, we cut back and forth. We see things from different perspectives. We see a few things over and over. And there definitely was, you know, there's editing at this point. We're not watching every 90 minute movie isn't just 90 minutes of somebody's life or anything, but to really start playing with chronology in this way, it's just, The Killing seems to be one thing that people point to as really kind of breaking through with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of a time when, again, that's another thing that jumped out at me the first time I watched the movie, where the first time he set a time earlier than the time he had previously said, I was like, wait, this is 1956. This is not what happens in a 1956 film. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It's just sort of the time shifting wasn't popularized in American cinema at this time in any way. I don't know that it was popularized anywhere in world cinema. It was, the French New Wave was probably playing with it plenty, but certainly not in America. I do just like, because I feel like I won't be able to sleep tonight if I don't mention this, but Tarantino still uses time shifting in all of his movies. I know what you mean. There's less of it now, but I think the best moment of The Hateful Eight is when you realize he has lulled you into believing that it's a chronological movie, and then you jump back 6 hours. But yeah, that is still something that's in the spirit of The Killing, just sort of a different thing. And what you're saying about especially his early career and playing with time, you can really see the influence of The Killing there.
Yeah, and to keep looking at this kind of on the continuum and to talk about that line that you draw, why maybe some 50s stuff just doesn't resonate with you as well. We get so much of our great 50s dialogue from the character of Sherry in this movie, who unsurprisingly, I love her stuff in this, and I think she delivers it very well. And that kind of dialogue, it really, I mean, she gets about 90% of the stuff that I don't think you could put into movies in the 60s or 70s, let alone today. Yeah. And I think it's very funny.
Yeah. Well, and Johnny Clay's fiance has a couple, like, I think the most 1950s lines in this movie come from Johnny's fiance. I forget what she says, but it's something like,
she's so ugly and worthless and couldn't do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Like, one of the first things she says is, you know, I'll go along with anything you say or whatever. And then towards the end of that scene, I'm not pretty and I'm not very smart. And I was just like, oh boy.
Yeah, okay. That one seems to be more the kind of gender politics of the time.
Yeah,
whereas
that's true.
I'm speaking more about like hard-boiled detective novels and noir stuff, like like, what would happen to the aspirin industry if you weren't giving people all these headaches?
Oh, yeah,
like, that meatball? Nah, that meatball with gravy now. Like, that kind of stuff, like, that really funny wordplay that sometimes is meant to be very serious, but, you know, it's still just all... it's still all predicated on these turns of phrase that now seem so like cheeky and quaint, but at times are played for jokes that sometimes are meant to be deadly serious.
Yeah, exactly. Like Clay saying about Sherry, I'm going to turn her face into hamburger or pretty face into hamburger meat or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Which is a deeply 1950s. Also,
it's very threatening, but it just, no one would say it like that anymore. So it comes off as so goofy. This many years after the fact.
Yeah. I also assume you love the fact that there is a character in this movie named John or Joe Piano, which I love.
Yeah. And Johnny gets one good joke when he says to the sharpshooter that the only thing they're going to get you on is shooting horses out of season. Mm. That's one more good joke that I needed to point out.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Was there anything else in the sort of ahead of its time sort of thing that you found interesting that you were reading about?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think one thing I was just getting to there is that they obviously, this is, you know, it's not hard to go down the film noir checklist and explain why this would fit with that. Mm-hmm. But just as that Sherry is one of the only ones that really gets that dialogue, or at least gets a large majority of it, it kind of feels like that is tucked away into her part of the movie and that it doesn't feel so film noir. And I mean, this is the end of the 50s, so a lot of that stuff is just going out of style in cinema across the board. But, you know, there's still kind of some of those hallmarks there, but it does feel like an end of the decade kind of movie.
Okay. I mean, it's the middle of the decade when it comes out, just for clarification. It is 1956, right? I've been saying it the whole podcast.
Yeah.
I hope I'm right. No, but, and yeah, I know what you mean. And also, not even just from her dialogue, but also from the way she's lit. It's a very classical film noir sort of lighting, like heavy backlighting. Her styling is very, very, it just screams, I am the femme fatale of this picture, you know? Not unlike most film noirs have a character that screams by way of their dress or their hairstyle, I am the femme fatale of this film. And I think that the lighting is a nice, really nice way to sort of tie this into film noir while also using so many elements to move past it. Because I realize I mentioned the dolly shots earlier, but I do sort of want to talk about them in more detail and why they're cool and why they seem very ahead of their time to me, because I'm sure you noticed them. Like they're moving across the, I don't even know, like lobby seems like the wrong word, but where you would place your bets at the racetrack.
Yeah.
Moving from there to the, excuse me, to the bar, just a long dolly track. Or dolly shot, it happens a handful of times with varying amounts of people in the room. Also, when we get character introductions in their apartment, like when we get our Johnny Clay introduction with the voiceover that says, you know, he's maybe the most important person in this heist. He's opening a drink, Coke or whatever, and it's a close-up of that Coke, and then we follow him like through three different rooms to get to his fiance, which leads to the I'm not very pretty and I'm not very smart conversation, but he's talking while he's traveling, and that the camera is sort of a low angle. It follows him through the space. There are like what you would have in these rooms. There are chairs, there are tables, there are lamps that the camera is just passing by. And it's always following Clay. But just having those obstructions in the shot, even for those brief moments, that's just something that it feels like was so uncommon at the time. And again, I'm not a historian of the 1950s in cinema, but that's just something that felt like Kubrick and Orson Welles would do and nobody else at this time. And it's just really cool. And the low angle's interesting. And the fact that he goes through multiple rooms and like the camera passes by a wall. And that happens like three or four times as far as characters passing through rooms in dolly shots. And the racetrack dolly shot happens probably four or five times on its own. And the obstructions in that case are almost exclusively people at the racetrack, but still very cool and very uncommon for a long dolly track to have so many obstructions. Yeah.
Yeah, and to talk about using cinema as its own art form and not just theater on film.
Yeah.
You know, it's I can't see the character as supposed to be watching. So, like, why is that lamp there? You know, it's so obvious that that should get out of the way. But to have a sense of realism and to play with a different art form.
Yeah.
Is right there. And I think that as we get further into Kubrick's career, that that motivated camera movement and the camera moving in sort of unexpected ways or ways that reflect something else about the scene and not just how do we show what's happening the most clearly. That's something we come to see as one of his big trademarks, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is like, this is the last of his movies that's more plot driven than anything else. You know, like pretty much every movie that he makes for the rest of his life after this, it's there's so much more to talk about thematically than there is from the actual plot. Whereas this is kind of calling it an X's and O's movie is reductive, but it's more of an X's and O's movie than anything that any of Kubrick's more famous movies. You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think of the narration since you mentioned it?
It's interesting. I am somebody that doesn't have a problem with narration in general. Like, you know, it's common to refer to narration as a crutch, as something you write into your screenplay when you're like, oh, how do I convey this information without having characters say it? I don't know. It feels like it's just a part of it. It sort of feels like somebody recounting what happened, like reading a police report. And that's what I think the voice is meant to signify, is that this is just sort of a just the facts sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not a very passionate narration, even though narration is typically, you know, very fiery. This seems even further to the other end of the spectrum.
Exactly. And the way that the movie is sort of laid out and the way that they play with time, it almost feels like somebody is one of those two cops at the end that's about to arrest Clay. Like, feels like it's 3 weeks from now and they've done all of their work and then they drop the file folder with all the statements in it. And yeah. Now they picked it up and are reading it in the order that they picked it up, even though that's out of order. You know, that's sort of the feeling of the movie. It feels like it's a story being told weeks after it ended. That narrator is somebody specifically reading police reports and just reading the facts. And then what we see is, not really, not a recollection, because it just seems too detailed for that, but like, you know, they're just the process of reading a police report where it's just, this happens, then this happens, but this happened before, and this happened later. You know, it's just, it's a police report with time shifting.
A police report that's like 100% research, but 90%. Put together.
Yeah, it was a police report that was done by a good cop that then goes to the bar for way too long at the end of the day and finishes their work at the bar. Yeah, you know?
Like this cop that we get to know the best in this movie.
Exactly. The famous adage is write drunk, edit sober. This guy wrote sober and edited drunk.
Oh, police work in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, my boss will think I'm drunk. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that was sort of any job in the 50s too.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. So as someone who hasn't seen Logan Lucky, is there a lot of this in there?
Ooh, there is like such a different tone to Logan Lucky than this movie.
Okay.
Just in
the racetrack aspect and
yeah,
a bunch
a good point.
Of putting it together for a heist.
I mean, I think if Steven Soderbergh was on this podcast and we could ask him a direct question, I think his answer would be, it must have influenced me at some point, but it wasn't a direct influence. He's always more influenced by, like, one of the things that he said was a specific reference point for that movie was The Hot Rock, which is a Robert Redford heist movie from the 70s, which is fantastic. And it's directed by, I think I want to say Peter Siegel. I might be wrong about the name, but it's the guy that directed Bullet, who's a really talented director. But like, it's such a style and fun movie, whereas Kubrick didn't make a ton of fun movies. And Soderbergh is more highly influenced, for the most part, by fun movies. You know,
Yeah. Yeah, and for all the nice things we have to say about Kubrick, being fun isn't one of them, really. I mean, there's moments of levity and comedy in this, but it certainly isn't doesn't appear to be the top of his to-do list.
No, I know. And I think I generally think he's funnier than he gets credit for, but I also realize I'm coming at that from a perspective of somebody who has probably seen most of his films more times than most people that I'm having this conversation with, you know? And that's, I don't know, a lot. So much of his humor is something that you just find, it's just like something weird and goofy, like Alan Cumming's one scene in Eyes Wide Shut, you know, which is so funny and so out of place. And that's the type of humor that exists throughout Kubrick's career. But I will say it does not exist in The Killing. You know?
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the actual heist, like Johnny's kind of big scene? Where he finally does the robbery, gets into the money room and all that.
I almost don't know what I can say about it other than it's fantastic, you know, like, because I think
what makes it so good then?
I think it's just the way that, I mean, it's all those things that we've talked about to this point, especially the use of time in the movie. It's specifically that we have seen events happening at this exact time by now. We've seen the guy, Maurice, get his shirt ripped off and have that fight, which...
Okay, wait. Maybe this movie is really funny now that I remember.
No, that scene is hysterically funny. I don't think it's on purpose. I think it's entirely built around... I don't recall the name of the actor who played Maurice, but it's funny because he's so hairy. And it's funny the way that his shirt gets ripped off. It's funny the way he moves his arms and the fact that he's so bald. It makes him feel like a David Lynch character that just appears halfway through this movie. And
he's just an unusually proportioned person too.
Yeah. Also that, you know, and like, I don't mean to body shame somebody, even though he's almost certainly dead by this point, like it's a lot of the humor just comes from the way that he moves and the fact that it's a fight scene in the 1950s. And we're just, you know, we've seen The Matrix and The Matrix didn't exist and wouldn't exist for another 43 years when this movie came out. So that
he died in a fight, believe it or not.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, wow. That's a fantastic piece of trivia.
It was a 5-on-1 though. So,
okay. Okay. So, but to go back to the actual heist, like the thing that is cool about that scene is that we're seeing that scene. We know that's Maurice's job. We see what he does. We see how that allows George to let Clay into the back room. And then when we go jump back in time with Clay to see him earlier in his day running through his various errands, and then getting the racetrack and getting into the position where he will be let in by George, we see the perspective of the money room finding out about what's happening with Maurice, and that's when the two people leave, and that's how Clay is able to get in there. And that, combined with the fact that we're hearing the racetrack announcer also talk about the injured horse, which we have now seen, which we previously saw Nicky shoot, all of those things come together in a way that's like seamless. It's just very cool. And having that racetrack announcer talk about what's happened and how they're unclear as to everything that they don't know that it was a bullet that took out the horse yet, but they mentioned that the jockey is okay. All of those things, I think, just come together to just give you the impression of something that was just fully thought through, which obviously it was, you know. And it's just really engaging.
Yeah, and there's something about that announcer and the idea that this is a movie that has a narrator, and there's this narrator, you know, the one that we meet first, the one who functions as kind of the, you know, the police reporter, the omniscient narrator. And he knows everything. And we've kind of trusted him to be this all-seeing eye. And, you know, he tells us what happened and when. And then we have this other voice of God, the announcer, who, as you said, doesn't know it was a bullet, doesn't know really what happened to the horse. You know, it seems to be trying to calm the sense of chaos that's taken over, but it doesn't have all the information. And just this idea that something about them being able to cause this much chaos, like even this voice in the sky that has more information than any one person should, you know, seemingly could gather on their own, that the racetrack has been put into such a state of chaos that even this booming voice over the loudspeaker is not is not fully aware of their plan. And as they, as it's speaking, someone's throwing a $2 million in a bag out a window and sneaking past cops. And just something about those two levels of they're able to function successfully and to fool this voice that's kind of been set up by the previous narrator, I think adds a good element as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Kubrick was good at what he did.
Yes, he was.
And thought about things that a lot of people may or may not have thought about in their films.
Yeah, and I did want to talk about Nicky and, you know, the two scenes that he has. Or, I mean, I guess we do meet him a little bit earlier, and then he has two scenes sort of at the parking lot there.
Yeah.
First of all, probably the toothiest speaker in the history of cinema.
He has such a bizarre way of speaking. He's in Paths of Glory as well. I mean, if I recall correctly, I believe that's the actor that's also in Paths of Glory, which is Kubrick's next film. As I was saying, like, the Kubrick we know began on Paths of Glory. He never worked with the guy that played Nicky again, because Nicky started to hate Kubrick on the set of Paths of Glory, because he would be asked to do things too many times. You know, the first in a long line of examples of actors being frustrated about working with Stanley Kubrick. But yeah, it feels like every line that he delivers, he is having like physical difficulty saying it, and he's just powering through. I don't know, like, there's just something so unique about him. To my recollection, again, it's been a few years, that's how I felt about him in Paths of Glory as well.
Yeah, there's something very unsettling about him. And even in the first meeting with him at his range or whatever, his property there.
Yeah.
You don't know if this is someone who just speaks oddly or is mentally deranged. Mm. And, you know, he doesn't do anything big and has no big emotional scene where he throws a bunch of stuff and you're scared of him. But there just is something unsettling about that, about him.
Yeah. Yeah, and one thing I really like about his character, I really enjoy his interactions with the parking attendant, who I don't think we ever get a name for, but correct me if I'm wrong. Just the way that I know he has a reason to be nice to him, because he needs to get into that spot in the parking lot so that he can get the angle he needs to shoot the horse during the race. But then he
has a reason to be mean to him.
Seemingly. Exactly. But when he is mean to him, you see a really brief moment of, and this is again something very small, but I think something that helps advance my theory of the this being a 1956 movie technically, but it feels like it was made a bit later than that. Just the fact that, I mean, the parking attendant is black, and he calls him the N-word just because that's the quickest way to offend him, even though they've been having, you know, human conversations to this point. The parking attendant says to him, like, it's really nice the way you've treated me, because you can only imagine how that parking attendant is treated in 1956 in general. And you see this really, really brief moment of Nicky, after he calls him the N-word, just sort of like registering that, like, he feels shitty about that. And I think that, like, again, I know, very small moment, but for 1956, to show a character in a heist movie be sort of remorseful for being racist is kind of cool, you know? And again, very small moment, but I think worth pointing out that it really fits in the whole ahead of its time sort of feel of this movie.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where to go with that, because I didn't know, like, after it's all said and done and you know he's dead, you can look back on what his role there was. I don't know if he's being genuinely nice at first and then you know, artificially mean just to achieve a desired result and, you know, be alone to shoot this horse, which we could talk about whether going into a parking lot with a convertible to shoot somebody is the wisest way to do that. Yeah. and not be seen, but I don't know if he's being nice and then pretending to be mean, or pretending to be nice and then letting his true self out. You know, his frustration is very sincere, and his racial beliefs at that point might be very sincere too. Mm-hmm.
I think it's just all in that one look of remorse, and I know I'm putting a lot in like half a second of acting, but I think that's the key moment there, where you're right that he has all the reason in the world to be nice to this guy just to get what he wants, but and then just just the opposite. Like, he has every reason to be nice or mean to this person to get him away from him so that he can shoot the horse. But just that brief moment of remorse, I think, is shows kind of that he didn't want to do what he did, you know, called him.
Yeah. And I mean, just to place this, you know, about a decade after the end of World War II, there is kind of the way that we think about the 50s in America, that conformity, that everybody was the same and everyone was conservative and everything, you know, people were making a lot of money at that time and everything was good for everybody, is kind of the really flat way that that is kind of looked at in history. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously not true at all. And I think that after World War II, and this is kind of what informed a lot of film noir, is that all these people were back home from the war, all these men returned and went through something awful, but now they're home and they're back in America and things are going to be great for everybody now. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously never ever the case, let alone when there are still so many backwards things about the way society was working, especially when we talk about racial politics in the United States and, I mean, most of the world. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that relatively short amount of time that we spend with those two characters, I think, touched on a lot of things where they're reflecting and growing closer, speaking about what they went through in the war, and they get so close so quickly, and then him using one word brings up, you know, 400 years of very, very awful relations. And they're still, you know, they can have this conversation and relate on all these things that they went through as people. And that is all well and good. And he brings him a horseshoe because he wants him to have good luck and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they seemingly are functioning on this very equal and positive footing. And so quickly that can go away because there was still so much just under the surface, and sometimes not even under the.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's, you know, and the fact that, like, I've been referring to this character as parking lot attendant because I don't think he gets a name, but the fact that this is kind of a nameless character, but he's still, they give that character enough that he feels like somebody with a life. Like, he kind of, like, in passing references, or implies that, you know, not everybody treats him well, but he likes this guy because he treats him well in a job where people aren't necessarily treated well, especially because of race, you know? Yeah. And
he points out that it's not the tip. Like, he's like, yeah, of course I liked the tip, but that's
exactly,
you know, having a nickel or whatever a tip is in those days is so far from what's really shaping his experience in America.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a bill, so it had to have been a dollar.
Oh, yeah. There you go. And parking was only 25 cents, so that's exactly at least a 400% tip.
Yeah. I mean, judging by the parking at the Air Canada Center tonight for the Raptors game, I feel like that's a $120 tip.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I just think, like, again, that's a really small moment that that I think speaks to, I don't know whether or not he was even intentional, and I'm certain it wasn't. It was just sort of something that fit the story, and it helped for these characters to have a couple conversations so that there would be a reason for the parking lot attendant to come back, and there would be a little bit of suspense as to how Nikki's going to get him to go away. But it was just sort of in the process of sorting out what was actually going to be said in those scenes. I think they add a nice little element to the movie. So also those scenes, Nikki dies. He gets caught for shooting the horse and gets shot. I think it's worth noting that in the book that this movie's based on, which I forget the title of it.
Clean Break.
Clean Break. There you go. Nikki gets away clean. And I wondered, I was reading one of the books I have about Kubrick, and just the section on the killing, I was rereading it, and that was something that was added into the killing, and the author theorized that it was because of the Hays production code, and I'm curious if you think it's the same thing, you know, like that's why Nikki couldn't get away without any sort of punishment.
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's 100% of what it is. Mm-hmm. That the villains can't be seen to get away with anything in this. And I mean, heist movies are interesting in that our main characters are usually our villains. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'm trying to think of a recent example, I guess, was it Rogue One? They're, or I don't know, one of them, they're trying to like steal plans and they're the good guys. Like they're
Yeah, it's the plans for the Death Star that they're stealing in Rogue One, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it's Rogue. Anyway, the point is, in most heist movies, like there are some heist movies that are exception to this, but often it's just people committing crimes, but they're George Clooney and Brad Pitt and they're charming, so it's fine, right? Like and maybe the guy is a dick too that they're stealing from, but he's usually not a monster, right? It's just he's wealthy.
But when it's Andy Garcia, you can really get on board.
Yeah, that's right. But that's something that heist movies do. They just kind of put us on the side of the criminal, of the bad guy. And so it puts us in an interesting spot, especially at this period in cinema where we're rooting for the criminal. We're rooting for what, you know, in a newspaper report is the bad guy. Mm-hmm. But we spend so much time with them and we want them to succeed because we kind of know them. And in this movie, it seems like our femme fatale is a different kind of femme fatale who just kind of lets loose what the plan is to somebody else. And, you know, it does seem like she puts it, obviously is intending to tell them that for a reason and put some things in motion. But yeah, the Hays Code didn't want the bad guy to get away with it. And it's interesting that the protagonists in this one are the bad guys just because of the nature of it. But yeah, Nikki goes down first and several other people die. And then we end up with Johnny not getting away with it, you know, not getting the money out of the country, but also being caught for attempting to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what you're saying about, you know, we're rooting for the villains. It's also just because these are the characters that the film sort of points us in the direction of identifying with in some way, you know. It's just these are the people we're introduced to. We are watching the story. We want to feel invested in the story. So we've got to like follow somebody's journey and root for them. And it just so happens that these heist stories are about criminals, you know, and it's just the way that we're introduced to them. Even when they're not played by George Clooney and Brad Pitt, as you said, even when it's Sterling Hayden, somebody who isn't like the most charming human being in the world, but you still sort of follow the journey with that character. And you just kind of root for him in some capacity just because the movie told you to. And again, this is all something that just happens in your head. You know, it's like not something that you're like, oh, this is the person who the film has directed me to look at and follow through this plot. Ipso facto, I will cheer rah-rah when he succeeds and boo when he fails. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think they kind of put their thumb on the scale a little bit by having one person with somewhat noble intentions, because isn't the bartender going to give all his money to his sick wife?
Absolutely.
So I think that, as I said, kind of tips the scales, and that we have a bit of noble motivation on the side of a not very noble act.
Yeah, exactly. And to a lesser extent, George wants to make his wife happy, which I know isn't like, it's not a physical need in the way that it is with Mike, Michael Riley, the bartender.
But we sympathize with him because he's just being pushed around so much.
Yeah, exactly. And he just sort of wants to feel like he has worth, which is something that he seems to have a real problem with throughout the movie. And but what you're saying about the one character who we would feel the most, or most viewers would feel is the closest to them, is the person that, in this case, is Michael Riley, who has just been given a raw deal with life, and who this is the way that he feels that he can correct that. Not correct that, but make it less terrible.
Yeah, and speaking of heists, as we were, I think we talked about this. We talked about it with Inception, and I think probably the Brothers Bloom, we spent a lot of time on it too, but the idea of the heist movie as a stand-in for the production of a film, did that strike you in this one at all?
I didn't think about it. I mean, you emailed me some points about it that I could then see it. And Soderbergh, I mean, you brought it up. This one's on you. In the run up to Logan Lucky, he was frequently asked this question, like, heist movies are kind of like you're breaking in somewhere and taking all this money to go have your fun elsewhere. And he has compared the Ocean's movies to that. Like, I can't believe we got so much money to go, especially Ocean's 12, like in reviews at the time. Reviewers were saying it's like Soderbergh and George Clooney robbed Warner Brothers and then went to his Italian villa and did whatever the fuck they wanted for 6 months. And Logan Lucky said basically the same thing. It does really fit very neatly. I think Inception is the best example of that, specifically because of the characters in it and the way that the characters in it very easily align with the filmmaking process, for reasons that we could break down at length, but this isn't an Inception podcast. I don't feel like those characters sort of exist in The Killing, but I also think that inherently the heist movie does really play into, if you want to look at something in a self-reflexive way, the heist movie just really plays into being a movie about filmmaking very easily, like almost all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, you're right. It's drawn more clearly in other things. I mean, here, I think we just have the financier, like the person putting money behind it. And then we have Johnny as, I guess, our director / lead actor, seemingly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just it's a collection of experts who all work towards a common goal. And I mean, it lines up in a few ways. I mean, the ultimate goal is that they want to make money. Mm-hmm. And there's some level of directing your attention to the wrong place, I guess. That is true of a film, especially directing a heist film and a real heist. You know, there is that misdirection that's so important that, you know, is pretty on the surface here too. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess they want you to believe something that isn't true in a heist, and in a heist movie or any movie, they want you to care about something that you know isn't real. Like you know these characters don't exist and that this is all pure fiction, but you invest it in a way that they can get what they want out of it. And in a movie, they're stealing money, and I get in cinema, they get your ticket price, but they you don't really have any tangible good at the end of it. But yeah. What you went through this experience, and now you're, you know, $13 poorer, and someone has that money that's not you anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And even just from the filmmaker to financier relationship, just we had to get, I mean, in this case, it's something like $200,000 that United Artists put up, and then Kubrick's producer, his last name's Harris, I forget, or producer at the time, last name is Harris, put up 80,000 of his savings and then borrowed another 50 from his father. But yeah, the 200 is something that you quote unquote stole from the studio to go and make a movie, you know, like it's just such a wonderful sort of job that you kind of feel like you're robbing people to do it. You know?
Yeah. Anything else about The Killing?
I think we should, I do want to talk like very briefly about, and I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts about this. It seems like characters in this movie, there's a couple times where people are like really nice people and it just is a huge problem for the heist, and it ends up making the people involved in them look shitty. The one that's coming to mind that we haven't spoken about is when Mike has the quote unquote flowers that's actually a gun. Also another reference point, Terminator 2, maybe that shotgun that Terminator carries around comes from this. But he's putting the flowers in his locker and people are like, oh, we can put them in the fridge so they won't die. And he's like, no, these flowers stay with me. And it just makes him look like a dick. And it's just something that he would look like a dick in that situation. Those people are trying to be nice to you and he just shuts them down. And you get sort of that moment of him being like, oh, what, just sort of briefly thinking about what he has to do in order to succeed in this. And the same thing is true with the parking attendant, which we talked about at length, but the fact that it's the horseshoe that stops Nikki from getting away. It's like he was a shitty person. And even in that one moment that ends up, whether or not he would have gotten away without that horseshoe lying behind his car, which the parking attendant throws as he walks away in anger. I don't know. That's just sort of an interesting tie-in of the fact that he wasn't nice to this human being leads to his downfall in some capacity.
Yep. Yeah, there's just these very clear examples of comeuppance. And even though, obviously, that parking attendant didn't say, like, hey, you're a dick to me, I'm going to stop you from getting out of here. You know, he was, it was kind of just this thoughtless thing that he did.
Yeah. Yeah, we never see him again after he throws the horseshoe.
Yeah, and even with Mike in the flowers, and I think it's worth mentioning that he, I mean, these are people he knows, you know, it's not just like some stranger or some employee or something. You know, if he got away with this crime or if he didn't get away with this crime, but, you know, the money disappeared and he had to keep working that job, there's mm-hmm. still that time that he was a dick to these people for really no reason. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just, I honestly think this probably wasn't a direct note about the Hays Code, but it reminds me of that, in that you can't be bad in isolation. Like when you start, when you start doing these things, you start, you can't compartmentalize like that. You know, I'm just stealing this money to give it to this person. I'm really a good person, but I'm doing this one incorrect thing. I think there's just a more Puritan view of morality, and that mm-hmm. things aren't relative like that, and that you never break the law or you never break the social contract, and mm-hmm. that bad people do bad things and bad things are done by bad people, and that relationship is always one-to-one, and you will get your comeuppance out of it.
Yeah, for sure. I also I've got a couple more things that I want to talk about, just from like filmmaking perspectives. I know I've mentioned a lot about what I liked about the dolly shots and their physical layout. Something that I think was really interesting that you might have noticed, because we've talked about this in the past, but so the vast majority of the dolly shots move from left to right. All of our character intros start, and the, like, again, that shot of Clay that I was talking about, that long one where he walks through three different rooms to get to his fiance, moves from left to right. The character, the financier, walk at the beginning, walking through the to the bar at the racetrack, left to right, and this continues and through our character introductions and everything. And even when a security guard is going to try and stop Clay when he's in the money room, the camera follows him from left to right, and then he gets to Clay, gets bumped by the financier, and then Clay punches him in the face and then exits. But then when Clay exits, he goes from right to left, and the camera follows him that way. And it's the first sort of time that the direction has sort of switched from I'm trying to get to this location to I'm trying to get away. And I thought that was like a really cool moment. And when he comes into the airline, it's less pronounced, but the dolly moves from right to left again, and then once the money gets starts blowing away after the luggage falls off the cart, he goes back to moving left to right again. And and I thought that was just like a cool filmmaking example, that like when he has a clear defined goal of getting away with a specific place that he's going to, he goes from right to left. And when but at the end, when he's sort of aimless, he knows he has to try and get away, but he just resorts back to going left to right. And I think that's an interesting filmmaking decision that's looks cool. And I don't know, I think speaks to the cleverness that Kubrick had.
Yeah, no, when something is that big and covers that much of the running time of a movie and ties in thematically, I mean, we talk about the best stuff having a complete vision, or things that you might not pick up on or be able to articulate, but has a whole feeling to it that might only be reaching you subconsciously, that stuff does matter, and that stuff does sink in. It takes someone who has made several things and thought about them very deeply to be able to take that many steps back and to have something applied to it, applied to what they're doing on that level, like on that scale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the last thing I want to talk about is just the use of the number 3 in this movie. We see that shot that the killing title card shows over. Did you notice this at the racetrack? That shot of horses being led out by jockeys, that the title card is over. We see that shot 3 different times, and it's sort of meant to replace us in the timeline of where we are at the racetrack. And there are also other examples of threes throughout the movie. There's 3 separate shots that I think tie in very, very well. We've got the shot of the sort of cardboard, paper, whatever cops that Nikki is shooting at in her introduction to him. Just framed like three people in the frame together. When Val comes to shoot, he ends up shooting the gang members at the end. We see a shot of them looking towards where Val is, and they're framed like three people are in the frame together, basically about to be murdered. And then the very last shot of the movie, where Clay is standing there, he's looking at the two cops coming out the door, and we see the end show up. There's those two cops, but there's also the airline employee right in the middle of them to sort of complete the rule of threes of that Kubrick and company have set out for themselves. And I think it's notable that the last line of the movie sort of plays into that when Johnny's fiance says, "Johnny, you've got to run." And Clay, Clay says, what's the difference? And I think that's a cool little moment, because in both previous examples of that, we're either seeing these paper things get, like paper cops or whatever Nikki was shooting at the beginning, see them get shot. We see the gang members about to get shot. And then we see Clay deciding not, like, that there's no point in running. There's no point in, like, I don't think he has a gun at that point. But there would be no point in shooting these people, even though that the shot is sort of framed like they're in a shooting gallery anyway. And I just think that's like such a fantastic, subtle sort of thing. And that's the type of thing that is, I mean, it all comes together in the last shot of the movie. So maybe modern Kubrick, or the Kubrick we know, doesn't start with Paths of Glory, but starts with the last shot of this movie.
It's at the very end of the
film. Exactly. But I just think that as probably like the most talented American filmmaker ever, I think it's worth noting how early things that we would come to know him for were present in his work, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect point. I don't think I could say it any better than that.
Yeah, Kubrick knew what he was doing.
Surprise, surprise, hot take.
Yeah, exactly. So thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.